Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York has suspended applications for a key housing program, just as Sullivan County legislators remain deadlocked over where to put a new housing shelter. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar has more from yesterday's tense legislative meeting. And Sullivan County Government Communications Director Dan Hoost is here, too, with more news out of Monticello, including major funding for youth programs and tourism, a commitment that could bring new water and sewer lines south of Liberty, and how two towns are teaming up to review a massive solar and battery project. Plus, the latest episode of our theater podcast, Curtain Call, with Tom Candela. And attention, young performers, River Rep Junior's Fall Workshop kicks off next week. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi talks with the team behind it. After the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. Confusion and turmoil continue to dominate a closely watched meeting of vaccine advisors to the CDC today. They're discussing changes to the childhood vaccine schedule. NPR's Rob Stein reports.
On Thursday, the committee voted to stop recommending a vaccine that protects children against chickenpox, along with measles, mumps, and rubella, for children younger than four. But the committee also voted to continue letting a federal program pay for the shots. On Friday, the committee acknowledged members were confused when they took that vote and reversed that decision. Then, amid more confusion and apparent dissension within the committee, the advisors tabled a vote to stop recommending vaccinating all babies against hepatitis B within the first day of life. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Israel has closed the only border crossing between Jordan and the Israeli-occupied West Bank. It has also suspended aid trucks bound for Gaza after a Jordanian truck driver killed two Israeli soldiers. NPR's Jane Araf has more.
Israel said Friday it had closed its Allenby Bridge crossing until further notice after the attack Thursday by a Jordanian driving an aid truck. It identified the two Israelis killed as soldiers. Jordan said a Jordanian truck driver hired 3 months ago apparently shot and stabbed the two men before being killed by Israeli forces. The crossing is the only access in and out of the Israeli-occupied West Bank for most Palestinians. Jordan, which has a peace treaty with Israel, is also a main route for food and medicine for Gaza. Israel said it was suspending access to aid trucks from Jordan. Jane Araf, NPR News, Beirut.
Turning Point USA has named Erica Kirk as its new CEO. The widow of Charlie Kirk takes over operations after her husband was murdered last week during a speaking event in Utah. She'll be one of the speakers at a memorial service for him in Arizona on Sunday. It'll be held at State Farm Stadium, and President Trump, Vice President Vance, and several other administration officials are expected to give remarks to honor the conservative activist. Turning Point USA held a vigil at Colorado State University last night. Tony Gorman with Colorado Public Radio reports.
More than 1,000 people filled the east side of CSU's Canvas Stadium to celebrate Kirk's life. Gabe Saint, TPUSA chapter president from the University of Wyoming, said Kirk gave young conservatives and Christians a voice across college campuses.
Charlie was more than just some guy or the guy that got the president elected, senators elected, congressmen elected. He was our hero as students on college campuses across the country.
For NPR News, I'm Tony Gorman in Fort Collins.
This is NPR News. A new report shows clean energy jobs in the U.S. continue to be added. NPR's Camila Domonoske says the latest figures don't count recent project cancellations.
For the last decade, the business and environment group E2 has put out an annual census of clean energy jobs. How many people are employed in solar, wind, electric vehicles? The latest report finds that clean energy jobs were increasing 3 times faster than the rest of the U.S. economy. The study is based on data from the U.S. Energy and Employment Report. That data set does not reflect changes since January, when President Trump took office and started rolling back funding and permits for clean energy. E2 notes that $22 billion in clean energy investments have been canceled or downsized this year, representing nearly 17,000 jobs. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
The city of Charleston, South Carolina, is ending its years-long legal fight against fossil fuel companies over climate change. The city says it won't appeal a state judge's recent decision to dismiss the case. Charleston's suit accused ExxonMobil, Chevron, and other oil companies of knowingly playing a role in contributing to the harmful impacts of extreme weather and climate change. Forecasters today are watching Tropical Storm Gabrielle in the Atlantic. It is getting stronger and may become a hurricane by Sunday. Right now, Gabrielle is about 900 miles or so southeast of Bermuda. The storm is expected to pass by the island Sunday night into Monday. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com and the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Sullivan County legislators still can't agree on where to put a gateway housing shelter. Some critics were warning the clock was ticking to apply for funding for the facility before state funds went away. Well, that funding is no longer available. On Wednesday, New York State suspended accepting funding applications for the housing program the county was scheduled to apply for. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar was at the legislative meeting yesterday as tensions unfolded, and she brings us this report.
Shame on you! Shame!
Thursday's Sullivan County Legislature meeting ended tensely after the legislative body failed to pass a resolution to set a public hearing for a potential gateway housing shelter on Sunset Lake Road in the town of Liberty.
Motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Louis. All in favor?
Aye.
County legislators were divided on how to move forward. Legislators Kat Scott, Matt McPhillips, Louis Alvarez, and Nadia Raj raised their hands and voted in favor of setting the public hearing. But
all opposed.
One, two, three.
All opposed, please
one,
raise your
two,
hand.
Three, four, five. It fails.
Legislators Terry Blosser Bernardo, Amanda Ward, Joseph Perello, Nicholas Solomon, and Brian McPhillips voted against it. Before the resolution failed, a handful of attendees held big white signs in support of the shelter. Other community members offered public comment, urging the legislature to pick a site.
This is the first step on a long journey. I encourage you to take that step because the picture is getting bleaker.
What's taking so long? Why is this not a priority?
And the legacy is going to be that come this time when people decide to do something about this, it's going to be too late because the money's not going to be there. And that's going to be your legacy.
That state grant funding is no longer available. Just a day before the legislative meeting, New York State's Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance, or OTDA, suspended accepting funding applications for the Homeless Housing and Assistance Program, or HHAP, on Wednesday morning. That was the program that Sullivan County was counting on to fund the facility. The suspension notice reads that the funding for the program is, quote, currently oversubscribed, end quote, and that the office is suspending applications to prevent applicants from expending time and resources. Radio Catskill reached out to OTDA to see if funding might become available in the state's budget next year. A spokesperson from OTDA said they expect to, quote, resume accepting such applications when additional funding is available, end quote. For more than 15 years, the county has relied on temporarily placing unhoused individuals in hotels and motels in Liberty and Monticello. That costed the county around $3.4 million in 2024 alone. That doesn't include any wraparound social services like emergency food assistance or mental health support, which the county pays for separately. Sullivan County legislators came close to approving a potential site in the town of Thompson earlier this year, but it failed to pass by a supermajority vote. 5 months later, Sullivan County legislators have yet to agree on where to build the facility. Sullivan County legislator Brian McPhillips, who voted against setting a public hearing, said that what's been presented to him and other legislators has been inadequate.
And some of the behind-the-scenes stuff just did not work out financially. So we keep talking about $8 million, that this is going to be an $8 million grant. The grant could be whatever the county needs the grant to be. We are stuck on a number that somebody told you. And that somebody that told you is not being presented to you the right way.
But that $8 million figure came from several presentations and estimates by the county's Health and Human Services team, as legislator Kat Scott pointed out.
The project that we are talking about that was proposed was a $3 million project 4 years ago, and that legislature kicked the can down the road, and it became an $8 million project.
She also noted the hypocrisy of Sullivan County legislators rallying behind recent economic development projects while failing to agree on a 20-bed housing facility.
So don't let them fool you. When they want it, they do it. They move quickly, they move decisively, and nothing stops them. So when people say they don't like being characterized as not having a heart, I think don't listen to the words, watch the actions.
Legislator Luis Alvarez warned the public to take stock on how each legislator voted to address the county's housing crisis.
Think who voted for it and remember who did not vote for
it. Right, that's right.
Keep that in mind. Because when the time comes for voting, remember who they are.
In Monticello, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Joining us now, Dan Hoos, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government, who joins us every Friday. Dan, good morning.
Good morning.
Just want to break down a little bit more about what happened yesterday. This was a conversation that's been, it's a conversation that's been ongoing about, you know, trying to find a site for this shelter.
For several years, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you and also the legislature were surprised by this state edict now pulling the funding.
Yeah.
That kind of came out of left field.
Yeah, just got announced yesterday. We didn't find out about it until halfway through the meetings yesterday. And then I ran to my office and made some copies of the press release that Kimberly actually was so good to provide to me. Your team helped give me the understanding that I needed on that. And then I provided that to legislators and county leaders saying, this funding isn't even available at the moment because we can't apply for it.
So that, where does this leave the situation in terms of trying to find this sheltered site? We heard Kim's report. What can the legislature do now if the funding has been removed for this cycle? We don't know if it's going to be there for next cycle. What are the next steps?
Well, there wasn't majority support for the resolution introduced by Legislator Kat Scott to use the existing plans that we had to build one at our social services campus in Liberty, which she had introduced in an attempt to get it through quickly so that we could apply for this funding from the state. But of course, as we found out, that suddenly became a moot point. So the legislature has been looking at another site in the Monticello area with an existing structure. We're waiting for the engineer's report to be delivered on that. And that was going to come in too late for this funding. So what I'd like to point out to people is that at this point, the majority of the legislature is not saying we're not going to do this. In fact, they're saying it's not going to be dependent upon getting that state funding, although if it's available, I'm quite sure the legislature will agree to apply for it when some sort of majority consensus can be reached. And as Kimberly was just saying, that consensus has been hard to come by over the past few months. So whether or not that consensus will be realized, I do not have the crystal ball. If I did, I would be winning lotteries left and right. But I am not losing hope that this is something the legislature is going to do in the future. I think that the majority of the legislature is interested in doing this. It's just always a question, it seems to be, of the site. Is the site adequate? Is it appropriate? Is it within walking distance of services? And I don't know if they'll even agree on this site. They got to at least got to wait for the engineer's report. But if this site doesn't work out, I haven't lost hope that they're going to be looking at another site after that.
And when will the engineering report be completed? Do you have a timeline?
I was told, I believe, the end of this month.
So. Let's talk about some other activity out of the legislature yesterday. Also related to funding, there's a congressional grant that's still in place for water and sewer services along Old Route 17, just south of Liberty here. What happened in that action in terms of
getting that completed.
Yeah, the town of Liberty, the county's been working with it on, we call it the Old Route 17 development project. I can't remember exactly what it is, but basically Old Route 17 parallels Route 17, the Quickway, south of Liberty and Ferndale, leading towards the town of Thompson Line, going down past, I think there's a veterinary office there, a doctor's office thing. It's all zoned for commercial industrial development, has been for a while, but it doesn't have any water or sewer service other than what you'd have to create on your own. So it's not really what we would call shovel ready. And working with the Partnership for Economic Development as well, we want to get this to be a shovel ready area. It's already zoned, so we just need that. Well, to extend water and sewer from the closest municipality, which would be the town of Liberty, I think the village is involved as well, is pricey. Takes a lot of money. So we have, though, been getting, Town of Liberty got a $20 million Fast New York grant from Empire State Development for construction of that infrastructure. Also got a $1 million congressional appropriations grant, but it has a $250,000 required match. And the town is not in a position to be able to do $250,000 grant match, but the county is. So legislators yesterday unanimously said, yes, we are going to commit that funding so we can make sure that water and sewer lines are extended down Old 17 to these properties so that they can be developed and create jobs and a better tax base.
Also, they passed the Community Preservation Program. We talked about this previously, but let's remind folks about that program.
Yeah, this is something that can be opted in by any of the towns and villages in the county now that the county has said, okay, we could participate with this. The county itself won't really have any other further involvement, to my understanding. Maybe our planning division will in guiding and advising people on this. But what it is, it can, and we had several people from the agricultural community yesterday speak in favor of this. It's about preserving farmland, open space, in a way that is doable and maybe even incentivized for local towns and villages. There's more to come about this. I'm not going to get into all the details of the program. Suffice to say that what was passed yesterday now allows towns and villages to opt into this program if they want to. It would create a real estate property tax on certain properties at a certain price point, not everything that gets sold. Would have maybe a percentage to go towards a community preservation fund. But that's up to the towns and villages as to how they'll do it. And up to them, too, their voters will have a chance to weigh in on that. So this is not something for people saying, uh-oh, I have another tax coming. No, your town has an opportunity now to look at this. And if they want to move forward with this, say to the voters, hey, this is what we'd like to do with creating a community preservation fund. What do you think?
Would that go into as soon as the November ballot?
I doubt it.
No.
No, I think that's basically set now. I think it's too fast for right. That. We're talking about next year at the earliest.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dan Hoost, Communications Director at Sullivan County Government, who joins us every Friday. Also, the legislature yesterday authorized an agreement with the towns of Thompson and Forestburg regarding a review of a solar and battery project proposed for those towns. What's this project and what's the latest on it?
Yeah, this is a project, I think well over 1,000 acres on the borders of the town of Forestburg and town of Thompson that is being proposed. They call it the Town Line Solar Project because it's on the border.
Clever.
A group of private investors, I believe, are working on this, and it's moving through the process with the state. The state encourages this kind of solar and battery storage project, but it's the largest of its type that we've probably ever seen in Sullivan County. And so there's an interest by us, by the town of Forestburg, by the town of Thompson, in ensuring it's the project's reviewed in a coordinated fashion that protects environmental, land use, public health, safety, and community interests. So we are going to jointly engage legal counsel and environmental planning consultants to assist with that coordinated review of the project so that we know what's coming, we can explain to people what is planned, and that if we have any concerns or issues that we can jointly get them addressed.
Is this a municipal project or it just requires
municipal
approval?
It's a private project.
Do we know the company behind it and what the use of it will be? Does it benefit the town in any way in terms of energy or any of those things? Is it just more of a facility within the town.
It may. It may not. We're not quite sure yet whether some of that energy generated will be local or just fed into the grid. But they are working on they have already a website up about it. I don't remember the name of the website offhand. But I think if you look up Townline Solar, you should be able to find it there. And they are, you know, obviously saying it's going to be a wonderful and great thing. But the county and the two towns are like, well, we want to make sure that it's great, not just for the future customers and the people who will be earning money off of this, but also for the residents and the town surrounding it. And we're not saying that it won't be necessarily at this point. We just want to make sure that everything is done as it should be with all concerns taken into account.
Let's talk tourism. There is a tourism grant program that the legislature approved, but actually pared it down. Let's talk about the Tourism Sector Enhancement Grant Program. What is that? Who benefits? And why was it cut?
The Visitor Association had proposed this, along with the county, using funds that have been set aside for this out of, I believe, room tax revenues that had been coming in quite healthily over the past few years. And they were going to go for a $600,000 program, but legislator Joe Perrello said, let's test this out first, see how this goes. Let's go for a $300,000 program. He's probably looking at an eye to the fact that we have a tough budget year coming up for 2026. And so we maybe aren't going to shoot quite as high as we were in the past. But once it was discussed, legislators are like, you know, we're fine with that. $300,000 is still a lot of money for local tourism oriented groups to access. There's also going to be a selection committee consisting of four legislators, Matt McPhillips, Kat Scott, Amanda Ward, and Terry Bernardo, our planning commissioner, Heather Brown, two SCVA board members, Scott Samuelson and Tanya Hahn, and of course the CEO of the SCVA, Michael Martelon. So they're going to look at all of that, and any funding awards that would exceed $25,000 would require approval from the county legislature as a whole in addition to that. So plus they also had a legislator, Scott, asked that they amend it to make sure that the grants are a reimbursable type. You don't get the money up front. You actually have to front the money first, and then you get reimbursed so that we don't have any fly-by-night folks who are taking the money and running.
And who is eligible, and what are these grants intended to help them do?
The grants, according to the draft handbook, which was with the resolution, the program exists to reinvest lodging tax revenues into strategic tourism development initiatives that generate overnight stays. That's a big one. Strengthen the county's visitor economy and enhance the region's appeal through events, culture, and hyper-local storytelling. So the grant funding is capped at 25% of the SCVA's annual budget to ensure its sustainability, and it will be for any groups that want to apply that think that they can attract people through some sort of event or programming that would lead to, in particular, overnight stays.
And when does that program open up for folks?
I don't know exactly when the SCVA, because they're going to be administering this, is going to actually, you know, the vote was just taken yesterday, but it's been in development for several months now. Michael, since he came on board with the SCVA as executive director. So I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of the year, if not before, that these rules are put out there and the SCVA starts promoting that you can apply for this.
And the youth, let's talk about the youth. Some programs for youth approved through next year with some funding. What are some of those programs and how much was allotted?
Yeah, I forgot that we do this on a different calendar basis than people would expect. This runs from October through September of next year. So October this year to September of next year is our funding calendar year for our youth bureau. And the legislature approved $130,000 of county money plus nearly $188,000 of State Office of Children and Family Services grant funding. So that's over $310,000, I believe, that is going to be going to a whole bunch of different organizations that deal with our youth. And not just necessarily what you would think, like Nesson Cultural Arts or the different town youth recreation programs and Bethel Woods Center for the Arts. Also going to, for example, the Catskill Fly Fishing Center and Museum, the Mammocating Library. There's a number of Cornell Cooperative Extension has a music and movement classes. The whole list of it is all on the resolution online that you can see. But I'm personally very proud that our county does this kind of work, because it gives youth, not just in our urban centers, but across the county, ways and means to experience all sorts of arts, culture, recreation, sports, things outside of their school buildings that really enhance and enrich their lives and their families' lives, too.
Let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk some more with Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. It's that time of year. No, not fall foliage, although we'll talk about that. Early voting.
Yes, it is.
Oh, boy. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on Science Friday, genetics pioneer Mary Claire King and her remarkable life in the lab.
The need to stick it out is really, really important. And if you look at all the people that any of us admire historically in whatever field, they're people who stuck it out.
Plus, how do you define what it means to be a genius? That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today, from 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's the beauty of bitterness. Not like, you know, feeling sore and aggrieved, but the magic taste that makes chocolate, coffee, beer, and so many delicious things delicious. That, and we take some of your cooking questions, coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11, on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're joined by Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. And the Board of Elections in the county is not wasted any time. They've got their early voting dates, the list of candidates, and more up. Tell us more about what's the busy folks at the Board of Elections have been doing to get us ready for November.
It is their very, very busy time, although they'd probably tell you there's really hardly ever any downtime, because you have primaries and you have petitions, and all year long there are things going on. But this, of course, is the busiest time, I would say, leading right up to this election, which is a heavy local election as well. There's town board races in every single town in Sullivan County. There's also, I believe, the town of Highland has a ballot proposition on to possibly reinstitute their constabulary.
We talked about that on Tuesday.
So, and there's, I think, some statewide ballot initiatives regarding the Adirondack Park. But what you'll find on our Board of Elections website that is particularly useful is the when and where of voting. A lot of people, a lot more people every year are taking advantage of early voting because it's more convenient to them than maybe voting on Election Day, November 4th. Early voting this year is going to start on Saturday, October 25th, and it will run every day thereafter through Sunday, November 2nd. Then we take a quick breath for Monday, November 3rd to get ready for Election Day. So the information on that is on there. It's going to be, as usual, at the Government Center and at Sullivan County Public Health in Liberty. I do believe, I think this has now been set, that because now we have security scanning equipment down in the lobby, that it's going to be moved upstairs to the hearing room. But regardless of that, we will, if you're going to the Government Center, we will direct you accordingly to make sure that you get your chance to vote.
That's for the early voting.
For the early voting,
and yes. Reminder that general election is November 4th. Let's talk about fall foliage. You have a photo contest again. Mm-hmm. It's always fun to see folks capturing the beauty of the area.
Yeah, this was very popular last year. We tried it for the first time through our Parks, Recreation, and Beautification office. Our assistant recreation director, Fiona Feltman, puts this together. And it was an instant hit right off the bat. We asked for people to submit, and we will again this year, photos of fall foliage at our parks and facilities. This is our D&H Canal Interpretive Center and Linear Park in Summitville, Fort Delaware Museum of Colonial History in Narrowsburg, Lake Superior State Park in Bethel, Livingston Manor Covered Bridge Park, the Minnesink Battleground Park near Berryville, the Stone Arch Bridge Historical Park in Canoosa Lake, and our County Cultural Center and Museum in Hurleyville. You can submit up to three pieces. You have to be the photographer, though, but it can be of any age. We do not discriminate on folks younger than 18 or older than whatever you think is old. We are looking for people to submit so that we can display their images at the County Museum, and the best of the best will get displayed, as they have been for the past year, around the sort of between the lower and upper floors of the lobby at the Government Center. And I believe there might also be some prizes involved with that, but I'm not absolutely sure. That doesn't say that on the poster. Listen, just the satisfaction of being able to display your work. And we really have a lot of talented photographers here. So I encourage everyone to apply. There's more information online about that.
The county tax foreclosure auction was this week. Was that successful?
Yes, we had very robust interest in county tax foreclosed properties, including, for example, we had the Delaware Valley School building in Calicoon. That got or will be sold. I mean, we haven't. We've got deposits for everyone, but nothing is official until right. we get all the money for it, because there's back taxes and things. I think there was a post office in Woodridge. There were a number of other interesting properties. Yes. So, but we received about $5 million worth of bids. Now, of course, this year, too, this any surplus above and beyond what is owed in the back taxes, we have to return to the original property owner by state law. That's going to take a couple of months. There'll be more information coming out about that. The original property owners will probably get a letter from our treasurer's office. But the only year that we had more activity than this was in 2022, when we had about $6.5 million worth of bids, but we had almost twice as many properties up, and we hadn't had a 2021 auction because of COVID. Mm-hmm. So we're thinking this is actually one of the strongest moments of interest in our tax auction that we've ever seen. Sullivan County remains a very, very interesting place for people to invest, to purchase. And of course, with the tax auction, you're getting properties usually at much less cost than you would otherwise.
The county official spent Monday updating the county emergency preparedness assessment. What is that? And what can folks learn from that prep?
I was part of this, actually. We had a room full of over 50 people from the county, from the state, from local towns as well, all from different disciplines, but all having to do somewhat with emergency response. In my case, I'm known as the PIO, the Public Information Officer for Sullivan County, and that also has an official state designation, is I'm basically the guy who's going to be the spokesperson when we have major emergencies in the county, and it gets routed through me. So I was part of that group where, how do we respond and plan to these emergencies? Not so much a strategic or tactical plan as much as a identification of our strengths, our weaknesses, where we need to improve. We did it 5 years ago, so we based it off of that. Have we gotten better? Or do we need more resources for particular events? Everything from flooding and wildfires to earthquakes and hurricanes. And I want people to know, to be assured, we have people who think about this, well, even more so than every 5 years, every day, who are figuring out, how do we do this? And not only how do we do this as a county, but how do we integrate and coordinate with the state, with the feds, to make sure that people are getting the services and resources they need in major disasters.
Any top takeaways from that assessment about what's working and what's not?
I think we're doing pretty well. You know, of course, people would say, well, you're biased, Dan. You work at the government. But honestly, looking at it from the old reporter in me, seeing what we have going on, listen, I don't think you can ever be 100% prepared for anything. But I would say that we really did identify some of our top concerns are, for example, power outages, active shooters. So that kind of stuff helps us identify and then really train and plan for it, because then we have groups, like I'm part of a group that gets together quarterly to go over public health threats and any pandemic or other issues that we're concerned about. And people are like, well, are we concerned about a pandemic anymore? COVID's long in the past. Doesn't mean that it couldn't come back or something else couldn't come back. We even talk about rabies and how that's going in the county. These things are continually being discussed. I want people to realize that their taxes pay for these people to be constantly on top of this.
Can folks take a look at that assessment online? Is that up yet?
No, it's not up yet. It will be at some point, but it's still in draft form right now.
And speaking of rabies, reminding folks, there's that vaccination clinic coming up September 30th. In the Mammocating Town Park in Bloomingburg.
In Bloomingburg, yeah. This is in addition to one that's coming later in October, I think in Monticello. I can't remember where that one was, or maybe that's Neversink. But this one just was announced this week because we had a rabid raccoon, I believe, in the Wurtsboro area. So Tuesday, September 30th from 6 to 7:30 p.m., Town of Mammocating Town Park in Bloomingburg, bring your cat, your dog, your ferret. No pre-registration required, but you will have to show proof that you are a Sullivan County resident.
And before we go, remembrance of POWMIA to folks today at 1 o'clock in the government center.
In the government center lobby, I will be live streaming it. So if people want to watch as we're doing it, it's a pretty short ceremony, but an incredibly powerful and moving ceremony about our prisoners of war and missing in action folks, men and women who have never returned home.
Dan Hoost is the communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday. Thanks, Dan. Have a good weekend.
You too.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, it's the latest edition of our theater podcast, Curtain Call. Tom Candela is here with a preview next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at catskillspropertycare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Jimmy Kimmel Live is no more.
It's an Occam's Razor situation. It's exactly what it looks like.
What it looks like is a steaming soup of government intimidation spiced with gobs of media consolidation. A toxic brew.
Nexstar has pending business before the government. Tegna also does. And there's another big station owner called Sinclair that also has business pending before the government.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Our theater podcast, Curtain Call, is hosted by Tom Candela. The new episode drops every Friday, and Tom's here with a preview. And you cover all kinds of theater, from the stage to what's up on the walls.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you for that intro. So, this week on Curtain Call, we actually covering two giants of Broadway, and that's Al Hirschfeld, the very famous caricaturist, and Stephen Sondheim, the lyricist, composer, you know, who had many, many Broadway shows. Well, these two worked together for many, many years, starting in 1957, which we'll learn in the podcast there. But basically, I sat down with David Leopold, who is the creative director of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation and the author of this brand new book, Hirschfeld Sondheim, in which he composed 50 of Hirschfeld's very famous caricatures of Stephen Sondheim shows into one beautiful book. I brought the book. I know our listeners can't see it, but I just wanted you to see it, Tim. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It's a great caricature of Stephen Sondheim. You just get it right away.
Right on the cover. And it's got an introduction by Bernadette Peters, and it's absolutely gorgeous. So yeah, this is a little bit different than our normal podcast or Curtain Call show because we're not talking about a specific Broadway show or a specific production. But we are talking about two giants in the industry.
Let's take a listen. It's the latest episode of Curtain Call Preview with Tom Candela.
Today, we're going to dive into the extraordinary intersection of two giants of Broadway. Al Hirschfeld, legendary artist whose flowing lines captured generations of theater, and Stephen Sondheim, the composer and lyricist whose work transformed the American stage. My guest is David Leopold. He's an author, curator, and creative director of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. And he joins me to talk about his brand new book, Hirschfeld's Sondheim, a stunning oversized collection of more than 50 drawings of Sondheim's musicals, films, and plays with rare archival treasures and commentary that reveal the creative kinship between these two masters. David, I want to welcome you to Curtain Call.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me.
So what inspired you to focus this particular deluxe poster series on Stephen Sondheim?
So we have a feature on our website, alhirschfeldfoundation.org, where it's called Spotlight, and we do exactly that. We shine the spotlight on somebody. And so I decided, well, let me gather up all the drawings that, of Sondheim shows and portraits of him and whatnot. And I put this group together, and it was more than 50 drawings. And I realized it told an incredible story of not only Stephen Sondheim's career, but Al Hirschfeld's. And I thought this would make a great book. And in a conversation I had with my editor at Abrams Comic Arts, Charlie Kochman, he's a friend, I thought, hey, would you be interested in doing this book? And he came back and he said, we should do it as a poster book, which I didn't know anything about. But then as we worked on it, it was clearly the right format. The book is different than any other Hirschfeld book that's ever come out. It's the largest book of Hirschfeld's art. It's a deluxe oversized book that is 11 by 14 inches. And in the book, there are 25 full-page reproductions that are meant to be removed from the book and put on the wall. It essentially gives people 25 prints of Hirschfeld's work for $30. You'll never get another deal like this.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. So there obviously there were many shows. How did you select? What was the process of narrowing down Hirschfeld's work?
Well, the drawings always lead the way. It had to be a great drawing. West Side Story's in this book several times. We have the original 1957 cast drawing that appeared in the Times the Sunday before the show opened. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you should understand is almost all of Hirschfeld's work appeared in the Times before the show opened. So he didn't know if it was going to be a big hit, a big flop, or anything in between.
Right.
And that was not his interest. He was not a reviewer. He was a visual journalist. And arguably, his drawings were as much a part of the Broadway show experience as opening night. So we chose West Side Story. We tend to think that caricature always focuses on the sort of flamboyant or the comedic. Mm-hmm. But Hirschfeld's work is full of great dramas and poignant pieces. So on back of each of the posters, we have some information about the actual artwork and about the show, when it opened, how many Tonys it won, you know, that type of thing. And then what I wrote for the book was the connections between Sondheim and Hirschfeld that reveal something about Sondheim's process as well as Hirschfeld's. But Hirschfeld, between 1976 and 1990, did drawings for a theater column in the New York Times that appeared on Friday, in the Friday weekend section. They started this theater column, and they asked Hirschfeld to illustrate it. And Hirschfeld in 1976 was 73 years old. Mm. He had owned the top of the fold of the first the drama and then called the arts and leisure section for decades. And now they were asking him to do a one-column drawing that would appear on the inside page of the fourth section of a paper. And they're incredibly strong, wonderful drawings. So there's one of Len Carreyrou as Sweeney that is just too good not to use. And so that's included in there, too.
So you touched a little bit on their relationship, Hirschfeld's and Sondheim's. How did that relationship evolve over the decades that they worked together? Was it very close?
Well, I can't tell you for sure. I spent 13 years visiting Hirschfeld in his studio at least once a week, mm-hmm. as I organized the archive of his work. And we talked about almost nothing besides art and theater. So for all the time that I spent with him, I have to say that we never had a specific discussion about his relationship with Stephen Sondheim.
Okay.
And that, of course, now is one of the things I wish I had talked about with him.
Mm.
But here's what I do know is that Sondheim was a great admirer of Hirschfeld and collected a number of the drawings, oftentimes for himself. So I know that they had dinner together. Mm-hmm. They were also Broadway first nighters. They were Broadway first nighters for decades. They got together like 70, 75 nights a year. It's not like they sat next to each other or as soon as they got to the party, they hung out, but it was their social scene. And so that world, everybody in that world knew each other. So, you know, Sondheim was a big fan of Hirschfeld, and Hirschfeld was a fan of Sondheim. They were both men of the theater,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's appropriate that they both have theaters named after them.
Yes.
And that gives you an idea of their impact on Broadway.
Now, you mentioned you spending lots of time with him over 13 years, going to, you know, mm-hmm. see him in his studio, watching him work. Did he ever allow you to see him squeeze in one of those Ninas into some of his work? Did you ever get to see that?
Well, I saw him do it, of course, because how Hirschfeld worked is he went to a production. He liked to draw from life. If a show was in rehearsal, he brought his 9x12 sketch pad and did drawings. But if a show was in performance, if he was seeing it while it was being performed, he trained himself to draw in the dark with a pad of paper in his pocket. And then he would come back to his studio. He would always ask the press agent for photographs because Hirschfeld wanted to make sure he had the costume right or the hair right, all those things. So we would take his sketches. That would be a combination of drawings as well as words, because the drawings told him what it looked like, and the words would often tell him what it felt like. And then he would come back, and he would pull out a board. He worked on a board that was roughly 20 by 30 inches. He would start working out the design in pencil, and when he felt that he got to a point that, okay, I know what this is going to be, he would stop and start working in ink right over the pencil lines. And he would sort of finish the drawing in ink. And when it was done, he would erase all the pencil lines.
Really?
And that was it. He was always drawing. He had an incredible work ethic. And he loved it. It wasn't work to him. He was a man who lived famously in the present. He did not think about the past at all. He hired me to think about his past. And so when someone asked him about the past, he would say things like, oh, you'll have to talk to my archivist. He's put everything in order, and now I can't find anything.
So you got the blame.
Yeah. I said it's actionable, Hirschfeld, so be careful. And but, you know, that was – he had such a humor about who he was and what he did. I mean, he was very serious about it. But Al Hirschfeld was a life lover. He really liked living, and people, they fascinated him. Put him out in nature, it was nice, but it didn't do anything for him. Put him in the middle of Times Square, he was in his element. Seeing people like that, because everybody was a different character to him.
Right.
And that's why I think he's particularly good on Sondheim, because Sondheim, the characters in his shows are really vividly etched characters. And for Hirschfeld, that was manna. He was always interested in character. He saw himself as a characterist. He thought he was doing, and he was, character drawings. Whether to get the character that the actor was portraying or the essence of the show, the character of the show, the drawings sort of capture what the shows were about.
I think what you mentioned back there about his artistry and his ability to capture the character in his artistry told you a lot about who they were just by looking at it, much like I think Sondheim's lyrics did for the characters in the songs that he played, because it described who that person was without banging you over the head with images. It was, you knew who he was by what he was singing or what the lyrics told us about the character.
Precisely. We're going to be doing an exhibition at the Algonquin, in the Algonquin's Oak Room, to coincide with the release of Hirschfeld Sondheim. It's going to run September 9th through 20th, every day from 12 to 7. In that show, there will be a special section in the show devoted to Sondheim, which will have some original drawings, some hand-signed prints. There's also this incredible portrait that Hirschfeld did of Sondheim in 1999. It's the last poster in the book, but that's the first time it's been published.
And the name of that show, just so people know, it's The Strokes of Genius, Hirschfeld at the Algonquin. Is that correct?
Exactly.
That's the name of the show. Okay.
And there's more than Sondheim works in there. I want to let people know this exhibition is, we have gathered some incredible original drawings. There's an original drawing of Do I Hear a Waltz, the Sondheim Richard Rogers show. There's an original drawing of Redhead with Gwen Verdon. That's just exquisite. One of Judy Garland at the Palace that is also incredible. An original painting by Hirschfeld of Carol Burnett that appeared on the cover of TV Guide. Hirschfeld did more covers for TV Guide than any other artist. I mean, incredible piece. And these pieces, those original, again, for those of us in the theater world, we always think of Hirschfeld in theater. There's a reason there's a Broadway theater name for him.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, again, that exhibition is called Strokes of Genius, Hirschfeld at the Algonquin at the Legendary Hotel in the Oak Room. And that runs from September 9th through the 20th, 12 noon until 7 p.m.
Completely free.
And it's free. Give us that website one more time, David.
I'd be happy to. It's alhirschfeldfoundation.org.
Great.
And if you sign up for our newsletter, you will learn about things as soon as they're ready to be announced.
David Leopold, the author, curator, and creative director of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. His new book, Hirschfeld Sondheim, stunning oversized collection, more than 50 drawings. That drops on the 9th of September. Anywhere books are sold, but you can also get it on Amazon. Okay, David, I want to thank you so much for being part of Curtain Call. It was really a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure to be on.
And you can hear the full episode of Curtain Call at our website, wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and turning now to the next generation of performers with River Rep Jr.'s Fall Workshop from River Rep Theater. It starts September 27th. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi sat down with River Rep's Christopher Petito and Arthur Alusi about why this workshop is such an exciting opportunity for budding performers.
Good morning to River Rep Theater.
Hello, hello.
We have Chris and we have Arthur here, and they are here to talk to us about River Rep Jr. What's River Rep Jr.?
Well, it is our first endeavor with offering acting classes and acting training to young people. It's between kids 8 to 18, and it's going to be a really wonderful, immersive, fun 10-week workshop led by Arthur and myself and some guest artists. We're extremely excited. It's a little bit like hoping to train the next generation of theater lovers and theater makers.
Well, I like that.
We both have some background in this. Arthur has done some teaching in the city, and I've done teaching internationally, both when I was living and working in Sarajevo, Bosnia. And as you know, I've been teaching here locally with Homestead School and at Sullivan West. And we're just excited to bring our combined experience with working with young people, which is so much fun and is very challenging, and try and make something exciting for the kids and get them involved also in working with us, because we're also trying to do some crossover now and have young performers in our actual main stage productions, which we began just recently with The Neverending Story. We had two young performers in that show.
Who were quite wonderful, by the way.
They were. On a side note, we are remounting The Neverending Story in December.
Good for you.
Advance advertising.
For one weekend at the DVO. And Waverly, who is one of the children in the show in June, will be taking on the part of the childlike empress, which was played by an adult originally. She had to jump in because that actress was sick for one performance. Waverly stepped up and did that and did a great job with it. The other child, Cooper, is taking over this part of Bastion. Lexi, who is playing Bastion, is taking over for Atreyu because Ellie J moved to San Francisco. So there's some shifting, but the kids who were in it in June are now in more prominent parts, and we're more than confident that they can pull it off. And we're going to have to fill those other parts, and perhaps we'll draw from our student body of at River Rep Jr.
Exactly.
Which, I have to say, is almost full. So if there are parents and kids, if there are kids out there and the parents of those children are listening, and your child is interested in this kind of thing, in getting on stage and learning some skills that are fit for the stage and beyond, what we're teaching will help them in all aspects of life, we think, we hope. If you have a child that's interested, it starts September 27th, runs for 10 weeks on Saturdays from 11 to 1. Registration is still open at riverrep.org.
Yeah. And to also just to do a little deep dive into what parents and kids can expect. Each week is going to be different. Each week we're going to be offering, well, mostly it's going to be a lot of fun. Kids will do exercises, games. They're going to learn how to work together as an ensemble. And then we will also get into doing some scene work and some monologue work. So kids will both, they will play literally, you know, we'll be doing games where kids get to play and interact. And then we will take that playfulness and plug it into some real acting techniques and acting practice. And at the end of the 10 weeks, we will have a presentation for the family and friends where all of the work that has culminated over the course of the 10 weeks is presented to in a friends and family performance. And we can share all the wonderful work the kids have been doing over the course of the 10 weeks. So we're tremendously excited. And as Arthur said, the workshop is filling up. We have slots left, but we do encourage parents, if they're excited and they're hearing this, to go to riverrep.org and register. It is a pay what you can. We don't want any barriers, financial barriers for parents and kids. So whatever you can pay is just fine. We encourage folks, of course, to make a donation to support the program, to support the artists. But it is a pay what you can structured program. So we are open to everyone, regardless of your financial circumstances.
Arthur, is there anything else you'd like to add?
As I said before, I think a lot of these skills transfer to all parts of life. It'll increase children's confidence, their ability to express themselves, using their imagination, using their communicative skills, working with others, being present in the moment. All these things are things that we all need more of in our lives in general, and we're hoping to instill them in these kids and then putting that to use on stage.
Yeah, and just to extend that thought of what Arthur is saying, it's we were just talking earlier today with Paul Silberto on his program, and we were talking about this whole idea that, you know, public speaking and learning how to get up in front of people is not something that is really necessarily taught in schools. Drama programs are almost non-existent. You know, there's some drama clubs, but there's a real thing about helping kids to get over their shyness. So if your kid is shy, this might be the perfect way for that kid to learn how to express their feelings, express their thoughts, get up in front of a room full of people and be able to feel a little less shy and have more confidence. And as Arthur was saying, those kind of skills can both help you in your personal life. And also as these kids grow older and they go out into the world and they become working professionals, this is really essential skill to have, is to learn how to be able to communicate, especially when all of these kids are so much in their screens and their phones. Just the simple idea of being able to have a conversation, look someone in the eye, communicate what you think and feel to them. It's just, these are critical skills. So that's another whole super important part of it, in addition to the just the fun of you know, the games and exercise side of it, is helping kids get that self-confidence through the work.
Being able to have an opinion, express that opinion, and then also hear other people's opinions and take exactly. those in. I mean, these are all skills that are crucial for good acting, but they should be crucial for
well, they're life skills. They are life skills. Yes.
Exactly. Yes. Problem solving.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So that has a lot of benefits.
Nations in ways that they might not otherwise use.
And have a lot of fun.
Well, how about giving us that information again so folks can get their kids signed up?
Okay. You go to riverrep.org, and there is, you scroll down, you'll see Riverrep Junior, and there is a You click
sign
on
up form.
Registration.
Yep. Just fill out the form and we will get back to you to confirm your kid's placement. And we look forward to hearing from you all and can't wait to work with your kids.
It starts on September 27th and goes for 10 weeks. One of those weeks is a week off. So it's 11 weeks out that it will end. But it's the 10 weeks, 11 to 1, Saturdays at the Delaware Valley Opera Center in Lake Huntington, New York.
Beautiful Lake Huntington, New York.
Yes, it is. Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing this with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, as always, Valerie. You are a great supporter.
Well, thank you.
Yes, we do.
And thanks, Valerie Manzi and the River Rep folks. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.